I'd like now to introduce Matt Miller. He is the co-host representing the political center of the show Left, Right, and Center, the radio program that airs at on 12:30 in the afternoon on Saturdays here on KSFR. And he's the author of the new book, The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, Letting Go of the Old Ways and Thinking to Unleash a New Prosperity. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So this is an interesting concept, dead ideas. Some of these ideas were once alive, and they're now dead, we'll go through all of them. And some of these ideas were always problematic in the first place. The dead ideas in your book, the first one is, the kids will earn more than we do. Then free trade is good, no matter how many people get hurt. Then your company should take care of you. Taxes hurt the economy and they're always too high. Schools are a local matter. Money follows merit, as in we live in some kind of meritocracy. And the first one, the kids will always earn more than we do, that's as much an expectation and a sort of historical reality than an idea. That's gone. Is that correct?
Yeah, and if we can step back for 1 second, what I'm trying to get people to focus on in this book is that dead ideas, I think, are kind of almost a universal thing in human nature, and it applies not just to our public life and our economy, which is the focus of the book, but it applies in our professional life or our business life or in organizations we work in, where it has to do with our slowness in adapting the way we think about the world, even though the world itself is radically changing. And so from our public life to our professional life, even to our personal life, I mean, in relationships, in anyone who's been married for a long time knows, you know, that these ideas can build up that are and habits of mind and ways of doing things that can not work anymore when things change. And so in that sense, it's something that applies to all of us at every level of society. What I'm trying to do with the tyranny of dead ideas is to get us to open our minds and rethink some of these ideas that I think are really blocking us from coping with our current economic challenges. The way I see it, the failure to explode dead ideas got us into the economic mess we're in today. So, for example, the idea that financial markets can regulate themselves is an idea that could have been exploded 5 or 6 years ago, right? With very modest common sense kind of rules or regulations on things like adequate capital for banks or stopping some of the bogus mortgages that got pushed through all the system. But our failure to explode that has left us with, the worst recession in decades and a big hole to dig out of. I think similarly, unless we explode the dead ideas that you started to mention on trade, schools, healthcare, taxes, and more that are at the heart of my book, we won't find our way back to a durable prosperity. I will say, not everybody shares my passion for getting beyond these dead ideas. I had the chance when the book first came out to do the Colbert Report, you know, with Stephen Colbert.
Right.
And one of the things that a couple of the questions they ask are things like, why should we get rid of the old ideas when the new ideas suck? This is the kind of questioning you get. Or why should we, even if the old ideas don't work anymore, shouldn't we still practice them out of a sense of tradition? And, you know, obviously my answer to that question, he was just having fun with that, but my answer to that question is no, and I want to persuade folks that we really do need to rethink this stuff if we're going to have the prosperity that all of us want. And when you point out that the kids will earn more than we do is sort of the stage setter dead idea I mentioned, what I mean by that is really, you know, upward mobility has been part of the American creed since our founding. And the whole idea that in America it didn't depend on what class you came from or how much money you had, but through hard work and pluck and determination you could rise from wherever you came into the world was something that has been captured by American icons like Benjamin Franklin or Abraham Lincoln up through the 20th century. And yet that tradition, which has had so much to do with the American character and personality, is now really beginning to collide with the latest research that shows that up to 100 million Americans are living in families that are earning less than their parents did at a similar age. And that's happening before we face the full impact of integration with rising economies like China and India. So I think we're in for a much more challenging environment in the next couple of decades, where this kind of upward mobility that so many people have taken for granted won't be on offer quite the same way. And I think that's going to force us to rethink what we think the role of the individual is, as opposed to the role of the community or government in making sure we have the opportunity and security we think a wealthy nation like the U.S. should offer.
One of the ideas, which I'm not even sure is dead or not, which underlies all of this, is that you can have an infinitely growing economy, whether that be local, national, or international economy. That seems like something that we have to think about as well.
You know, and there are people who will often say, are there limits to growth? Are we, and there's certainly important questions about, are we destroying our environment with the certain patterns we have that we've used to fuel economic growth? But I guess I don't think, I'm of the view that people who bet against the ability of not just the American economy, but the sort of the world economy to keep growing over the long term are, in some sense, don't read history right, because I think that the economic value and economic growth ultimately gets created by what's in people's heads. It's the breakthroughs in science and technology that lead to new innovations and new medicines or new services or new computing. And those things will always, I think, because mankind is so ingenious, there's always new ways to fuel economies that harness, you know, human imagination and ingenuity in ways that create new businesses and wealth. I do think that while this process, I think, can continue indefinitely, we still have to be very careful about things like, drawing down our natural resources and inheritance that are, you know, things that assure that we can have the kind of life we want and should leave to our children on this planet. But I don't think they have to be at odds. I guess that's my point.
Let's talk for a moment about free trade. In your book, you talk about how there is a kind of ideology of free trade, no matter who is benefiting by it or not. You also mentioned that virtually every country, and certainly the United States, has had protectionist policies before they could afford to do free trade.
I think that's right. And when I say that dead idea is that free trade is good, quote unquote good, no matter how many people get hurt, that's really what I'm driving at, which is I think, you know, economists in both political parties today who whisper in the ears of, the senior politicians on both sides and presidents as they cycle through on both sides, make the case for free trade as if there wasn't any downside, even though they know there is. But I think that they've been so emphatic out of a worry that we would end up in a kind of protectionist spiral like the 1930s that really does hurt everybody, that they're not honest enough about what we know are the millions of people who lose out from free trade, and they really poo-poo what we should do as a society to make sure that even the losers end up having a kind of health security or pension security that we want to make sure people have, or transition assistance or unemployment aid, where the United States has really been a laggard compared to a lot of other countries. And so the point I'm trying to make is that more social insurance is really the flip side of an open economy. I'm not a protectionist. I don't think we should be shutting our borders. But I think we have to acknowledge that trade hurts lots of people, and there are things we can do to assure a shared prosperity, even if we're going to have the kind of open markets that mean that some people are going to be subject to this kind of competition.
So when people are in Washington are trying to get first NAFTA and then Central American free trade and other types of free trade systems, how does the United States benefit, and how do these other countries benefit or not? And in the same but different way, when you talk about countries like China and India, what's going on when we talk about free trade with those? Because they seem like very different cases.
They can be different to some extent, but in general, I think that broadly speaking, U.S. consumers benefit enormously when we're able to source lots of common products, from T-shirts to toys to different kinds of clothing, obviously with proper safeguards on things like some of the toys and stuff we've had problems with from China. But it's an enormous boost to the average American standard of living when things can be imported more cheaply at the same or higher quality than having them made here. And that's really no different than saying that if California can make things cheaper and better than in Nebraska, and Nebraska has some things they do cheaper and better than California, trade between those states is beneficial to both sides also. So trade with the world is just a, a bigger version of a phenomena of trade in general, where if people can specialize in things that they have an advantage in, all sides can benefit from that. The downside, though, obviously, is that there are people who, people in the U.S. who, if we import lower-priced clothing from abroad, those industries here ultimately end up declining. And that's part of the change that takes place in any economy. And I guess my point is that we should be making it possible and easy for people to adjust when that happens, and that it shouldn't be a devastating thing for a family when industries rise and decline, which is an inevitable part of capitalism. And, you know, today, because our social safety net is so screwed up, in my view, when you've got health care tied, in most cases, to employment. So in the current recession, 14,000 people a day are losing their health coverage, 100,000 a week because of the job losses we have. In other countries, when people lose their jobs, they've still got their health care because it's not tied to their employment. And so those are the kind of things I think we have to rethink if we're going to make sure people feel secure to even tolerate this kind of economic change.
We're talking to Matt Miller, author of the book, The Tyranny of Dead Ideas. So that leads to this other dead idea that your company should take care of you. And that looks back to a time in the United States when we did have a corporate welfare, which didn't mean companies receiving welfare, which is what it means now, but you had companies actually providing health insurance, pension, housing, and all sorts of benefits. We are so far from that right now. A lot of people don't qualify for those things, or they don't exist in the first place. What, I mean, is that idea not, how is that idea not already long dead?
Well, I guess it's in this sense, because even though some of those benefits may have eroded in recent years, most Americans still get their health care from their employer. And that, again, that is a totally unique thing among advanced wealthy nations. So even with the pullbacks that we've seen, I think it's something like 180 million Americans get their coverage, and their families get coverage from somebody's job. And again, that may have made perfect sense, 50 years ago after World War II, when we were the only economy left standing and when healthcare was a lot cheaper. So it was actually relatively inexpensive for corporate America to pass on through slightly higher prices, which is what they did, the cost of much of America's welfare state. And back then you had, a single breadwinner working 35 years at a big company that could have benefits, and the family around them, benefited from that. But today, as we know, instead of healthcare being 5% of GDP, as it was in 1960, it's 17% of GDP going to 20. People change jobs frequently. Young people who have 10 jobs before they're 40, that's the, one of the famous statistics. And so these healthcare costs are sort of killing business competitiveness, even while they're leaving millions and millions of people falling through the cracks. And it just doesn't make sense anymore to tie, to have the primary way people get healthcare in America be on their job. And yet, it's very difficult to actually get people to move past this idea. Business is very schizophrenic about this, because when I talk to CEOs in the book, even though they'll say in one breath that the costs are killing them, and I'll say, well, I agree with you, we need to find a way to shift more of these costs to government, they'll say, well, wait a minute, we don't want government involved in this. And I'll say to the CEOs, well, who else do you think is available? And so there's a bit of an ideological sort of barrier, especially in the business community, about shifting some of these costs toward government, because they think it means the slippery slope to socialism. And that gets reflected in the way President Obama is now proposing health care reform. Even if privately lots of leaders on both sides might say we need to move past the employer-based system, it's very difficult for them to say that publicly now, paradoxically, because often it's business is saying, well, we're not sure we want to get out of this, even while it's killing them cost-wise. So it can be very confusing. So I think it's a very live idea that needs to be, it's a dead idea that needs to be unearthed, and we need to move beyond it, because I think we can't get where we need to go as a country with employers at the center of our welfare state.
That leads to one of your, what you call in the second section of the book, destined ideas, that only lessons learned from abroad can save American ideals. If we have an ideal of providing health insurance to all of our people, it's pretty easy, and it's actually been done by T.R. Reid, whom we're also speaking to on this program very soon, to look at how other industrialized countries do their healthcare systems.
Yeah, I think we should, and I think... you know, the whole in the front half of the book, I have the dead ideas, which are kind of a mini biography of each of these ideas, where they come from, why they make sense for a long time, and then what changed in circumstances that make it now perverse or harmful or dangerous. And then in these destined ideas, where I'm saying where things are going to really destined to go over the next 10 years as the current economic crisis plays out and the continued march of globalization, et cetera, force us to change our mindset on these things. We used to be very open to ideas from other places. You know, America used to take the best ideas from anywhere. And today, you know, if you say, well, we should let's think about what we can learn from Finland on teacher training, or Singapore on pensions, or Switzerland and Holland, where I think we can learn a lot about healthcare. In Washington, very often, you know, the answer you get is, well, that, you know, those ideas may be fine for some small, benevolent Asian dictatorship or a sauna-loving tundra of the North, but we're America, damn it. You know, we can, you know, we're going to figure it out for ourselves. And yet, we modeled our university system largely after what we admired and what the Germans had done. We admired our whole political, we modeled our political institutions, except for the monarchy, a lot after what we thought the British had, right? So the idea that we're going to need to look to ideas from abroad, especially where other nations are doing a better job today combining growth with equity, which I think they are, means there's a lot to learn. And I think Switzerland and Holland are good examples in healthcare where, you know, often the fear is that if, especially among business people, that if we shift past the employer-based healthcare system and have government take on more of this burden, it means that we have to become a socialist kind of state, which I think is really nonsense. And Switzerland and Holland are examples where the government essentially gives people a coupon or a voucher to go buy a decent family plan from among competing private insurers, and it harnesses market forces for public purposes in a way that, you know, I think fits with what American kind of ideals and values are that we could learn from.
We're talking to Matt Miller. One of the chapters is called Taxes Hurt the Economy and They're Always Too High. And you tell a very interesting story in the book about a Republican Reaganite named Bruce Bartlett, who basically looked at George Bush the First's prescription drug law that was passed under his watch that really transferred a huge amount of basically tax burden onto the American people to provide prescription drugs for the people of this country, and basically ran the numbers and said, no matter how you slice it, we are going to be paying higher taxes. And he was essentially excommunicated by the Republican establishment for saying that was a good thing, which he wasn't. He was just saying that is an inevitable thing. And as you point out of the book, Democrat or Republican, we have signed up for taxes, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, and that's and you're exactly right the way you described the fate of poor Bruce Bartlett, who got excommunicated from the Republican Party for intellectual honesty, basically. And
right.
Well, you know, the point I'm making is on taxes is, look, as we go through to fight this recession, most people's taxes are going to be cut by President Obama. But once we're through this recession, and it will pass, we're not headed toward anything like a 1930s-style calamity, and so this will pass. We're throwing a lot of spaghetti against the wall, the Federal Reserve throwing more against the wall in this past week, and the big stimulus plan, et cetera. So we will come out of this, and then there's no question, once we're back in a stable economy, over the next decade, taxes will rise no matter who's in power, because we're going to retire the baby boom. And that means we're going to double the number of people on Medicare and Social Security, including the prescription drug plan you mentioned. And right now, there's already $50 trillion in unfunded promises in those programs, so the math just doesn't work at current levels of taxation. So taxes are going to go up as a share of the economy. Now, and not just on the top earners in the country. It's going to be more broadly shared. Now, the good news is the economy's still going to be fine. We're not going to become a very high tax state like France or Sweden, for example. We'll be somewhere between where we are now, and we'll be somewhere higher than where we are now, and somewhere less than where those other big welfare states are. But the economy will be fine, and these are undiscussable facts in our politics today. As you mentioned, as I cite in the book, a Republican who tried to be intellectually honest on this basically gets banished from the party. Democrats are afraid to talk about this truth because they know that the Republicans are always hammering them on the tax issue. But it's, you know, the idea that deep tax cuts as a core principle of economic policy can continue, it just can't. We can't. For all the money we're already borrowing from countries like China, China will not pay for the entire baby boomer's retirement. Right. Nor should we want to borrow that money and make our children pay even more for our choices in terms of the benefits that we think that we want to assure ourselves. So, and when taxes, the fact that taxes do have to go up inevitably, no one may want them to, but that's in the cards. We should seize the opportunity that affords to actually rethink the way we tax ourselves so that we're taxing ourselves in ways that are better for economic prosperity and growth. And in my mind, that means lowering taxes on things like payrolls, which are that's a regressive job-killing tax that now puts a higher burden on lower-income people, and cutting things on, cutting taxes like payrolls and on corporations, because right now we have higher corporate taxes than elsewhere in the world, and that hurts job growth. And raising taxes on things like dirty energy, where for environmental reasons we want to shift away from all these fossil fuels, and higher taxes on them is one way to help incentivize the new energy innovation we need.
We're talking to Matt Miller, author of the book The Tyranny of Dead Ideas. Let's talk for a moment, before we get to some of the new destined live ideas, about how it is that the tyranny implies monarchy or dictatorship. Tyranny of dead ideas. Who is tyrannizing us with these? Is it totally a media thing?
I don't know if it's totally a media thing, but it's the culture generally, and I think I do think you can fault the so-called opinion leaders in society, and maybe here on public radio we're some of them, but those who really shape in the media, public officials, policy analysts, business leaders, professionals. The kind of opinion-leading class in the country, I think if the society is being held back by dead ideas, you probably have to fault the opinion leaders as being the ones who are helping propagate them. But I think these things just build up in societies over time. And in large measure, I think this is all a function of the fact that after World War II, we've had a pretty remarkable sort of 60-year run where America had this outsized economic dominance. And because of that, we built up a lot of ways of doing things that may have worked when that was the case, but now as you have the rise of China and India and other countries, which from a global point of view is a fantastic thing for humanity. You've got hundreds of millions of people being taken out of poverty because of their access to global markets and the way they can contribute now to the global economy. But that means that we're now facing new kinds of competition that we didn't have before, and just as anyone who's in business knows, if you've been sort of cruising along fat and happy, and then suddenly you've got new competition from new people that enter your market, or something changes in technology and you've got new competition from people you didn't have it from before, all of a sudden you find that you've got to rethink your old ways of doing things, because you'll head for a cliff if you don't really update and overhaul the way you're running things. And I think the U.S. is writ large is facing that kind of thing that businesses face or organizations face when external circumstances change, and that means that all of us have to adjust, how we think about where we get our health care, what the role is of corporations versus the role of government, how we educate our kids and what the role of, local versus higher entities are, if we're going to thrive and flourish in this new era, which we can. If we just, I think the battle to save our futures in this respect really starts inside our heads, but once we let those tumblers click, there's no question we can renew our prosperity for the long term.
So in terms of your what you call destined ideas, and it's a very strong word, as if this is our destiny, like it or not, and maybe it is, only government can save business. Now, we've talked about health care, shifting health care to government. Let's talk about bailouts. We're in the middle of this situation right now. How do they actually work in the long run? Does that money go back into our economy?
Yeah, I think... when I say only government can save business, I mean on the healthcare and pension front, I think government needs to play a greater role and get that off being a business's big burden. But on the bailouts that we're seeing currently, I think this is sort of an extraordinary event for several years, where because nobody else can step in to bolster the banking system, which needs it, we're going to end up with large stakes, whether we call it nationalization or not. We've already effectively nationalized institutions like Citigroup and Bank of America, because we're also essentially guaranteeing lots of their against any losses they may have on big chunks of these toxic assets. So, but I think you have to think about that as a kind of several-year crisis intervention. That then we'll make sure we don't want to have state-run banks, and even Democratic presidents and officials don't want to have state-run things in this way. And we'll find a way to re-push this back to private investors and private shareholders once we get through this crisis. So I think that's where that will shake out. But we will end up with new regulations that'll make sure that we can't let freewheeling, laissez-faire financial systems get us into this disaster again.
The next idea is only business can save liberalism. And that's one that's really, I think, counterintuitive for a lot of people. Explain what you mean.
What I mean by that is, and my more liberal friends say, what do you mean by that? Is that the healthcare and education sectors of our economy are two of the biggest sectors of our economy, yet they're also radically inefficient. Healthcare, we spend much more than other nations, and we still have no better health outcomes. We got 50 million uninsured. Same with education, not to quite as a dramatic a degree, but we spend more than other wealthy nations, and yet we're in the middle to the bottom of the pack on most of the international tests. And we're going to have to. It's really a liberal imperative. If we're going to have money for anything else to use affirmative government for, as the boomers retire and themselves devour a lot more of our federal resources, that the only way we're going to have the resources to do other things, like, say, for poor children, is to re-engineer the cost structure of the healthcare and education sectors so that we get better quality for less cost, which happens in almost every other sector of the economy, but health and education have been largely immune from this. And I believe that in our society, entrepreneurial, innovative energy comes from the business sector. And I'm not talking about any George W. Bush privatization agenda. I'm talking about things that deliver more value for less cost. One good example, so people understand what I mean, is in a lot of the Target stores or Walmart stores now, you'll see these things called Minute Clinics that are opening, which are essentially lower-cost medical services run by, instead of having a doctor there, they're run by nurses who are lower-cost, who can do earaches, sore throats, some kind of vaccines, a bunch of the strep throat, a bunch of the common ailments that if you go to your regular doctor or, God forbid, to the emergency room, costs much, much more to deal with in those other settings. But you see an innovation that, is open 24/7, that people can come into without an appointment, wait only 10 or 15 minutes, and get a lot of common problems treated for lower cost. I think business innovations like that, that harness market forces in ways that are good for public purposes, will help us in education and healthcare to deliver more for less and thus free up more money in society for other things that I think in our system liberals tend to want to use money for, and myself. I would like us to be able to devote resources to things not needlessly just padding the health and education sectors when we can save a lot of money and do a better job.
Although I have to say, listening to you talk, I mean, when you look at the healthcare systems of Japan and Germany and Switzerland and so on, the way they actually make those work is they have government fixing of prices, of salaries, of the cost of equipment, the cost of procedures, the cost of drugs. That is direct government intervention.
It is, and that's why, and I'm not saying that there aren't some advantages to that system. But I guess my own view is the reason I'm wary of that level of government control of U.S. healthcare is because I think we're on the verge of this enormous innovative era in medical technologies and drug discoveries and ways of really transforming what healthcare could mean in the next two or three decades. And I worry that if we went the statist route, you know I want government to play a bigger role in financing these things and creating incentives for people to have the coverage they need. But if we go a real statist route on all pricing and sort of system control, I think that will hurt the innovative capacity that has the ability to bring enormous benefits to society. And so I want to strike the right balance there.
We're talking to Matt Miller. He is the author of the book, The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, Letting Go of the Old Ways and Thinking to Unleash a New Prosperity. And I just said that wrong. I'll take it up again at the end. So we've gone a half an hour right now.
Uh-huh.
So let me. I wish we could talk more because there's a lot more to say. But anyway, let me go in here into asking you about public radio.
Okay.
Matt Miller, tell us about why people should call right now to support KSFR and get a copy of your book.
Well, of course, I want them to read the book. But to me, seriously, public radio may be one of the only places you can find in our culture today where you have the luxury of time and you have a kind of shared community where people are interested in ideas and are given the opportunity to explore them and exchange on them in any depth. I mean, I know from my own life as the host of Left, Right, and Center, as compared to other media outlets I may engage in, when you're trying to have a conversation about something that is more than a soundbite, it's very hard in today's culture to find places where you can actually engage with your fellow citizens in a way that is more in-depth. And I think, you know, at a time when there's so much change in our country, when we're going through so many challenges, unless we have a safe place to come together to actually communicate and share thoughts and not just do it in sort of 10-second bites, I worry for our democracy. And so if you care about democracy, I guess that's my point, you need to support KSFR and support the mission of public radio, which is basically about building a community where all of us can help reason together and address our common challenges.
I think when you say this, it makes me think about the importance of having what you might call a civilized discussion. A lot of what goes on in the media is really high-pitched or angry and, as you say, very, very rapid. And this possibility of actually kind of sitting down and talking and thinking together certainly promotes, if nothing else, the death of the old ideas and the birth of the new.
Well, I think that's right, and it's not a coincidence that on Left, Right, and Center, for example, we always bill ourselves as the civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate, because I don't think it's a choice between something that's like a circus carnival, you know, of people yelling at each other, but then the other alternative is some dull, boring way of engaging, because I think if you're engaging with other bright fellow citizens on the issues of the day, that can be interesting and dynamic and exciting. And so we end up with like a parody of what a conversation is like on so much of, especially the different cable channels, which is why Jon Stewart can be so wonderful, because, you know, he has so much fun riffing off the inanities of cable. But if you didn't have public radio in the culture, it's just hard to know where you could tune in to actually hear a more in-depth conversation about the things that we know matter hugely. And a lot of these issues are complicated, and it's hard to deal with them in 2 seconds. And it doesn't mean the alternative is to be dull about it, but it means you need a little time to elaborate and engage people with other points of view and to find common ground. And, you know, the idea that a shout fest is the place to do that, I think, is crazy. And so public radio just has a unique, vital role in our civic society in preserving the republic.
Matt Miller, thanks so much for being with us.
It was a pleasure, and thanks so much for having me.
Okay, thank you very much. And this will air on Monday, and I guess we're all set.
Thanks a lot, and thanks for all your thoughtful questions.
I wish we could have gone into it more, really, because the one thing that we didn't talk about that, I don't know if you want to do it another time or whatever, but there is this whole, when you talk about the free trade thing, you know, these poor farmers in Mexico who can't sell their own corn because their villages are flooded with American genetically engineered corn, and that leads to this big question of people's relationship to the land and other non-economic values.
Those are good questions.
Well, maybe we'll do it another time. Okay, so thank you very much. And, Sean, I'm going to do a couple of pickups.
Thanks a lot. And
okay.
hope the pitch was okay.
Yeah, no, it was perfect. It was perfect.
Okay.
All right.
Bye now.
Sean? Okay, so turn down his pot, and let me do a bunch of pickups. No. Okay. I'd like to introduce Matt Miller. He is author of the book, The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, Letting Go of the Old Ways of Thinking to Unleash a New Prosperity. We've been talking to Matt Miller. He's the author of the book, The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, Letting Go of the Old Ways of Thinking to Unleash a New Prosperity. Matt Miller, what do you... What do you mean by the term dead ideas?